Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Charlie Kirk, Democrat Charles Lipson, Republican John McGovern, and Salim Muakil also joining us this evening. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. If you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And tonight, we introduce our new Twitter account. If you want to tweet to me, you go to btbdumont. BTB Dumont, and again, at the moment, we have two followers. We're going to start the show with two followers. I'm new to this, so we're going to see. We'll have a report at the end of each segment as to how many followers we're picking up. But again, BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont, and again, we'll see how many followers we pick up, and who knows, maybe I'll start following you if you want me to do that. Anyway, we begin tonight in the first portion of our program. A great deal of the show tonight will deal with the death of Nelson Mandela. There may be controversy about what I'm saying, but I think certainly in my lifetime, and I'm 69 years old, there probably has not been a more significant world leader than Nelson Mandela. Salim Muakil, have I overstated how important this man was and is?
I don't think so. I think that any kind of objective assessment of leadership would place him high up there, if not at the top. I don't see there's anyone who could compete. Perhaps someone like Gorbachev or someone who initiated a big change in their nation and shepherded it in a way that was unexpected. And yet maintain a kind of stability that was that a lot of people are surprised by. I mean, you know, the normal expectation was that he would want to be vengeful. He would want to at least some sort of compensatory policies would be enacted under his reign, and that really didn't happen. And I think that his move toward peace and reconciliation was a model that a lot of people may not have agreed with, but they were so astounded by the audacity of that move that it registered in a way that anything else I think wouldn't.
Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago also joins us, political science professor for over 30 years there. Charles, have I overstated his importance?
No, and I'll tell you why. When you think about somebody like Martin Luther King, why is he so important? Not only because he was important personally, but because he personifies something very important, which is the overcoming of racial segregation, at least legal racial segregation, pervasive in the South. Why did Nelson Mandela matter? Nelson Mandela mattered because more than anyone, he represented the possibility of overcoming the kind of colonialism, white domination of Africa and Asia, parts of Latin America, that we associate from the middle of the 19th century to maybe the middle of the 20th century. South Africa wasn't a formal colony, but it was dominated by whites. But what made him so important were two or three other things. He not only led to a black majority country, to a majority country, but he did it with, as Salim was saying, with a generosity of spirit, with an effort to include people in it. And most importantly of all, he actually gave up power. When you think about the people who led liberation movements around the world, the Ho Chi Minhs, the Fidel Castros, the Ayatollah Khomeinis, and so forth, what did they do? They hung on to power until they died. This man voluntarily gave it up. That doesn't mean South Africa's past its problems, right, but it means that he laid the basis for a possibility.
John McGovern, you spent many years working with House Speaker Dennis Hastert. What was the relationship of the power elite in the United States, the members of Congress, the Speaker of the House, with this transformational figure who again, when he was released from prison in the 1990s, became even larger than life, even though he was on a pedestal or on a mantle before that?
Well, I think that's a complicated question because I think we have to put it in historical perspective, and this is something we're talking about a little bit before the show, that there was some commentary the last few days about Reagan's position on his release and sanctions, etc. And we have to look at that from the fact that they were looking at it from a battle with communism. And that South Africa was one of these places that was a proxy for the fight between communism and freedom, which was so ironic given the fact that of Mandela's own personal situation. So I think over time you started to see a shift. And in the late 80s, you had a number of new Republican congressmen, including Newt Gingrich, Vin Weber, who opposed President Reagan, and pushed for sanctions. So it was an evolving relationship. But I think once Mandela was released in 1990 and then became president in a extraordinarily peaceful transfer of power, that it became a very strong relationship. And I think another thing we have to give Mandela credit for is, not only did he give up power, but he also didn't take the opportunity to enrich himself. It didn't become a kleptocracy like so many of the other
Zimbabwe,
Robert Mugabe and all these other dictators. And I think the fact that he was able to marshal a already strong economy and society into an even stronger one today that's part of the G20 and that's really a leader, I think is really extraordinary. And certainly I think that helps strengthen the relationship with both Republicans and Democrats in Washington.
Charlie Kirk also joins us. Charlie, you're 19 years old, so this is all new to you.
Very much so.
And also for the last couple of weeks, there's been this media bath about John Kennedy and the assassination 50 years ago. So as a young man, when you live through all of this discussion, and you're a political guy, you are a tried and true political junkie, how do you as a young man put Nelson Mandela into context with what you've heard and what you've read and what has been dominating media for the last 48 hours?
Well, it's really interesting. Growing up in the public school education system, we read a lot of Henry David Thoreau and a lot of the civil disobedience doctrines. And to see somebody who lived that and embodied that and then actually put it in political change is really, really, life-changing to really look at it for my generation, because we don't have an equivalent figure that I grew up with in the last 20 years. But to hear about and to read about and to see the bipartisan, across lines, people honor this man's life. You see people like Ted Cruz and Pelosi say the exact same thing. You couldn't tell what they're saying. You know that this man lived an extraordinary life. People like Bill O'Reilly and Rachel Maddow both honor them in the exact same context. It's really, really special. And for me personally, to see somebody embody the doctrines of Henry David Thoreau and civil disobedience is really something that should be honored.
But again, Newt Gingrich was on today because he took a lot of heat when he said the nice things that he said about Nelson Mandela, putting him in this historical context. He took a lot of heat because of that from his Facebook and his Twitter followers. We're going to pause. 1-800-723-8229. Let you weigh in as well on the passing of Nelson Mandela. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back, reporting that those who have gone to the tweet at BTB Dumont, we've soared to 14 followers. We've gone from 1 to 14 in the first segment. So again, at BTB Dumont, if you want to follow our activities on Twitter. Salim, coming back to you to the importance of the discussion here. We have the former presidents of the United States, with the exception of George Walker Bush, who's not health-wise able to go. But again, the four presidents of the United States, the Pope is going there. I mean, it's the extent to which the world is honoring Nelson Mandela. Charles mentioned the problems that still exist in the country, and also the remarkable decision that he made only to serve one term as president, because he could have served probably until the day he died. Why is that an important lesson for other leaders to follow, at least those that come out of a revolutionary background.
Mandela, it was a very unique circumstance for him. You know, I mean, the South African system was pretty well established and stable. There was no need to establish kind of a one-party system, which other liberation leaders did. People who, you know, folks who were involved in the anti-colonial struggle, if they managed to survive after winning a victory and were installed, then it was generally a one-party system that they had to install in order to assure allegiance. And that wasn't the case with Nelson Mandela. And I think also there is some reason why so many people are attracted to him, and because he was one of those rare people who mastered both, you know, what you would call the poetry of revolution and the prose of governing.
But he was also
a very difficult thing. But he was also a revolutionary.
He was a revolutionary, and he was a communist.
He was close to the Communist Party. Okay. He was a Marxist. He had a lot of affinity for Marxist ideology, uh-huh. And that's undeniable. And I think we forget about that a lot. That's why I think it's good that people like Cheney said he opposed them for a reason, because we tend to the Santa Clausification of these figures. Right.
I've never heard that, Salim. I think you made up a word.
Well, it used to be seasonally appropriate. It used to be called the deification, but now, you know, it's ecumenical.
The hagiography. Yeah. You know, that's often what happens. But I mean, he's a complicated cat who was pretty much a revolutionary in the beginning,
but also not unlike what was happening with the civil rights struggle in the United States, mm-hmm. Because he was imprisoned, there were those that came along after him when he was in prison who were far more revolutionary, far more violent,
yes.
And not suggesting that there was not moments of violence that he participated in. And certainly his wife, Winnie Mandela, was certainly, I mean, she has been excoriated by all of the tribunals that have looked into her. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been too much about her, but that was a marriage that ended, in a very unpleasant way as well.
Well, that's a domestic matter that I would not like to delve into. But I think there was some ideological.
No, but I'm saying but she was no angel.
Well, she was a hardliner. She didn't want.
She was more hardline than he was.
In fact, she was. Yeah. She was.
Well, she was associated. I don't know. You may know more about this, but there was a lot of not only interracial violence around that time, but there were violence among different black groups, including what was called necklacing, where they threw burning tires around people and incinerated them. And Winnie Mandela was at least associated with that in some court documents and so forth. The fact is, Nelson Mandela changed in a very dramatic way from his early life into the period where he got out of prison. It would have been easy to imagine a person becoming embittered, more radical. He actually developed a way forward for South Africa that would incorporate whites and blacks, preserve the stability that Salim was talking about. Look, we're having an election today in Venezuela, and it's not an honest election. Chavez's successors are stealing that election as we speak. So the
allegedly.
Oh, I don't think alleged. Well, I'm alleging it. And if they don't steal it, it'll simply be because they're not competent enough to steal it. The fact
there's
is, there's
capital.
No guarantee.
There's a lot of capital trying to keep them from being victorious.
Well, I hope they're successful. I hope they're successful, because the fact is most people who try to become transformational leaders will turn that into a dictatorship of themselves and their party.
So back to John, you were going to make a point.
No, I was just going to make the point about, you know, whether he renounced his Marxist affiliation, or, you know, the ANC renounced his ties to the communist Soviet Union or whomever. You know, it's interesting that he was part of a generation that included others who were overthrowing oppression of communism at the very same time, whether it was Havel in Czechoslovakia or Lech Walesa in Poland.
The Pope.
I mean, there was a movement not it wasn't just the racial intolerance and the situation in South Africa, but it was about freedom and getting rid of oppression in all sorts
That's
of
right.
All sorts of countries and all sorts of ways. And I think it really, when the wall fell, you know, this proxy using the ANC or using the white government in South Africa or whomever as a proxy against either communist or anti-communist, I mean, that all went away. And so it became, you know, it gave him the opportunity, I think, to move beyond that and not to be saddled by it as he moved forward.
Go ahead.
It also reduces his options. Without communism as an alternative, he had to.
That's an interesting
right,
point.
That's
a very good point. The interviews with Pik Botha were important, too. That is, there were people on the white side in South Africa who wanted to reach out to him. He reached out to them. There were some alliances, political alliances that were formed. Those turned out to be very important.
Well, and there was a lot of talk today about our ambassador to South Africa at the time, Reagan's ambassador, who worked very diligently behind the scenes with the white government to try to ease the situation without having to make it public to go against what the U.S. position was in terms of fighting, you know, the communist threat that
Reagan
they saw
and Thatcher,
in South Africa.
Reagan and Thatcher were very reluctant when many other countries were boycotting South Africa. Reagan and Thatcher in Britain were very reluctant to do it. Some say, especially in the British case, there were economic interests involved. But there was a real question, I think, at the time, whether when Mandela came out of prison and led that movement, what direction it would take. And that's one reason we can celebrate today. We now know the direction it took.
But
when,
and that's why when, he's so when he, popular. One of
yes,
the reasons why
that's
everyone
correct.
Embraced
that's absolutely,
and I think that's
but,
why he's
so,
been celebrated
but my question
here.
You see, yep. is when, you know, Charlie, just to point to you, I mean, the reality is that, you know, a line in politics is, you know, is this a guy that's going to walk the walk and talk the talk? I mean, a guy that spends 27 years in prison mm-hmm. is a guy that's walked the walk. And during those 27 years, whether it was for all 27 years or the last 25 years, whatever it is, I mean, there was a transformation. There was something that was happening to him in that prison that he said, I'm not going to be bitter and resentful when I came out, because there were a lot of people probably in South Africa who were hoping that he was going to be that way.
Absolutely.
I'm sure a lot of his,
were probably
his supporters, I'm sure.
So when he comes out, in essence, and again, he was not known for being a religious man in the traditional sense.
Still isn't, really.
But yeah. this is the ultimate turn the other cheek role that this guy, you know, took on in his life, which gave him, I think that's part of this heroic,
yes.
level that he has.
He embodied some characteristics that we don't see in politicians, as we say nowadays, forgiveness, and you mentioned humility. I mean, stepping down after one term is, I mean, could you imagine any other politician nowadays just doing that?
No.
With the kind of ground, I mean, if they took a poll, for lack of a better term, in South Africa that time, he would have had a 99%, you know, they would have reelected him 100% and put him on the shoulders and put statues all over
right,
the country.
Yeah.
And forgiveness and humility, you don't see those kind of characteristics nowadays in our leaders.
When we
Charlie.
Look back at why George Washington was great,
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons was that after he led the victory in the Revolutionary War, he gave up his military leadership. When he became president of the United States, he did so because he was asked to do so. He had to be asked to take on the second term. He then left after two terms. His successor, John Adams, was bitterly opposed by Thomas Jefferson, but when Adams was defeated by Jefferson, he reluctantly left office. He didn't stay even for the inauguration. He left late at night so he wouldn't have to see Jefferson. But it's that leaving power voluntarily and turning it over, if necessary, to the opposition party with an expectation that they will then turn it over to you if they lose. These are crucial moments in the development of government by popular consent.
Question to you about the 27 years in prison. Is that the most admirable part of his life? Or was it the transformation that he was not going to be resentful? You couldn't have one without the other, I would think.
That's right. But he didn't volunteer to go to prison.
It would not have surprised anybody if he would have been very bitter when he gets out. I mean, frankly, it seems to me that you know, because we've talked on this program a long time about, you know, over-incarceration in the United States. I mean, it seems to me that he sets a standard for young black men, many of whom are in prison. You know that, Salim. It sets a standard that there can be forgiveness and a loss of bitterness when someone ultimately is released from prison.
Well, aren't you struck like I am that sometimes when these people are released after wrongful imprisonment, some of them are bitter and some of them are just forgiving. Right. It's just, it seems to be built into some people's souls.
Yeah.
They realize the uselessness of holding on to resentment.
Yeah. We have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion. And also, we'll talk about fast food workers. Do they really deserve $15 an hour? We'll talk about that when we come back. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, that time of the broadcast where we let each of our guests go around the round table and explain exactly who they are. We begin with Salim Muwakkil.
How you doing? I'm Salim Muwakkil. I'm a writer, a radio host, a teacher. Been in Chicago for a while doing journalism and activism. Came out of the Black Panther Party, was a member of the Nation of Islam, journalist. Started with the Associated Press, worked in both the mainstream and alternative media.
Village of Harlem?
From the Village of Harlem.
And, Rutgers and University?
Rutgers University, yes, sir. And here I am.
John McGovern.
I'm John McGovern. I'm an executive vice president with Resolute Consulting, a national public affairs firm based here in Chicago. I've been involved in Republican politics and campaigns for over 20 years, including spending 8 years with then Speaker of the House, J. Dennis Hastert, a congressman from Illinois.
And Charles Lipson.
I'm Charles Lipson. I'm a professor at the University of Chicago, where I teach international politics and do some other kinds of teaching about politics, and have been with Bruce on this show since before Twitter was a gleam in anybody's
That's
eye.
That's right, yep.
Bruce said that I was a Democrat. I was surprised to hear that. I am. I agree with the Democrats.
I just wanted to give you a little cover when you go back to the University of
Chicago. So they'll let me have lunch. I agree with the Democrats on many social issues, and I agree with Republicans on many fiscal issues and foreign policy issues.
Charlie Kirk.
I'm Charlie Kirk. I'm 20 years old. I founded Turning Point USA about 16 months ago, a youth organization that educates college and high school students on fiscal responsibility, free markets, and capitalism. I've been on the show a couple times, and you can follow me on Twitter, at CharlieKirk11.
There you go. And I'm up to 19 followers now, so yes. We've added 18 more people.
The revolution is beginning.
That's right. At BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont, D-U-M-O-N-T, doesn't make any difference, it's not other uppercase, lowercase, but again, give us a jump on and begin to follow us. Let's talk about another reason. We're going to switch from the discussion of Nelson Mandela to another big issue that got a lot of coverage this week, and it's one that I think a lot of people probably have an opinion on one way or the other. And that is fast food workers. A lot of them around the country, they rallied. They don't believe that they can live on $7.25 an hour. They're urging $15. At least some of their leadership are suggesting that we get up to $15 an hour. Since many of the people who work in these jobs are young people, Charlie, what's your take on what is a livable wage for someone who is working in a fast food or, you know, for minimum wage in the United States?
Right. When we're talking about minimum wage, I think we should first take a couple steps back and ask, who are the people that are earning minimum wage and how long are they on these jobs? People who are earning minimum wage are more likely to be a suburban teenager than to be a single mother, and almost all studies and metrics show that. But when we talk about raising minimum wage, the irony of it is, and the people that are protesting, you know, if they got what they want and they got a $15 minimum wage, studies show that almost 27% of them would lose their jobs overnight. I mean, imagine that if they actually got the wage increase that they wanted, then they wouldn't have their job tomorrow. And we talk about these fast food restaurants, $15 an hour, that would also increase the price of the hamburger that you get and the cheeseburger and the fries and the chicken nuggets. And in the climate that we're in right now, where young people can't find work, 15% unemployment, the last thing we should be doing is raising the cost of production.
But why would they lose their job?
Well, because it would raise the cost of production and it would harm or threaten a lot of profits. Now, this is just we're talking about fast food workers, but it would be hard.
Corporations would make less money.
Right, which, of course, we know that it's we're profit-driven in the free market economy that we're in. So if they're looking at their profit sheet and they have to now pay $15 an hour for labor, they either have to raise their prices dramatically, which might make them uncompetitive in certain regions, or they have to let people go, or they have to go towards more automation technology, which would further raise the unemployment rate. So we have
Charles, what's your take on this? And would you acknowledge that this is an issue? This is a growing issue that's getting more. It's getting more media coverage. It's getting more currency, and more people. I think a most recent suggestion, or at least a survey that I saw, is that the majority of Americans do believe that you can't live on $7.25 an hour.
Well, it's a symbol of rising inequality, which concerns people around the country. I have many of the same concerns that Charlie just raised. Over time, one of the reasons the United States has had such a highly mechanized economy, starting here in Illinois in these fields where there weren't many people to harvest the grain. In Europe, they used a scythe. Why did McCormick invent the reaper out here, where a couple of horses and one person could do what 10, 12, 15 people used to do? Because there weren't 10 or 12 or 15 peasants. There was just a family out on the... If you raise the wages, over time, what you'll get are machines that do much of the work that human beings do. But there's another reason why I find the government's effort to raise minimum wage a problem. These are human beings, adult human beings, who freely chose to work in that job, and a company that freely chose and is not a monopoly. There are many other jobs available. So the individual has a choice of jobs. The company has a choice of jobs. And in between them, the government's going to insert itself and say, even though you, Bruce, want to work for me for a certain wage and I want to pay you that wage, they won't allow that transaction to occur. I think that's a mistake. It's a mistake at the moral and ethical level as well as an economic mistake.
Salim, I want to get your reaction to that. You may have a different view on this issue.
Oh, yeah. I think it's atrocious to expect people to work for the wages that they're being paid in fast food industries. And I think it's a symptom of...
But can you address the ramifications of an increase that Charlie and Charles have...
Yeah, I think corporations will have to be less profitable. I think it's a ramification of capitalism. Capitalism, when you engage in free market interactions, the disparities between the rich and the poor automatically rise and automatically separate. And that's why we have the widest disparity, the widest income disparities in the history of this country right now. And if we don't attend to it, the price that you pay for that kind of rampant capitalism is taxes. And we've been going in the opposite direction, and that's why this disparity between the rich and the poor is widening now than ever before.
I would argue that over the past 5 years, we've seen inequality grow and grow, but that's the right. Policies being put forth by the administration are anything but pro-free market. I mean, we've seen tax increases, regulatory burden, Obamacare, which is the antithesis to free market capitalism, yet we've
and
seen...
That's why medical expenses are going down.
But no, I would argue that inequality is a byproduct of cronyism, not capitalism. We know cronyism, which means that corporations lobby politicians to get handouts.
The basis of capitalism is inequality. That's the purpose of it.
Not necessarily. John McGovern.
Well, I mean, I think Charlie's right. I mean, this is part of a trend, right? Whether it's Obamacare, whether it's more regulation. I mean, it's everything that the government is trying to do to tell employers and businesses how to run their business, how to make a profit.
How to operate a society in which inequality is lessened.
But if we don't give people the opportunity to innovate and be risk takers and entrepreneurial and make money and have something to reach for, you know, then the entire economy stagnates.
So the other thing that I'm concerned about is that it seems to me that, you know, if this were to move and grow and $15 an hour became the standard wage, the major corporations, I think McDonald's, Burger King, all the major chains, they would roll with the punches.
Wouldn't bother them.
It wouldn't bother them.
That's right.
But it seems to me that it would drive out of business whatever remnants there are of mom-and-pop restaurants.
Right. And that's exactly right. It's not just about, you know, the minimum wage isn't just for fast food restaurants.
Right.
It's for everyone.
Well, yeah.
So there's a lot of companies and a lot of employers who can't afford that. And I think it goes back to both what Charlie and Charles were saying about, one, It gives employers an opportunity to employ less people because they can't afford it under the higher wage. And at the same time, it drives them to more automated efforts because then it's just a lot cheaper. So we're creating fewer jobs both ways.
I had an experience just the other day, and I think it was probably I went in there on the day when there might have been a slowdown. At least that's the way I've sort of analyzed it. I went in to the local Einstein just a block from the museum. I went in there. There were only two people working. There usually are five. There were only two people working that day, and there were 20 people waiting in line to be served. And I waited 10 minutes, and I left. And that's a place where I eat usually two or three times a week. And the next day when I went in there to see if it was getting any better, they basically said that this was a dictate from the company that now they're reducing the number of people. And I say, well, do they know that they're losing customers? I mean, literally, my friend and I, we were not the only two that walked out because we were not going to wait 25 minutes to get, a pizza bagel or whatever the case may be. And it seems to me that in many cases, at least in fast food experiences that I've had in the last several months, I mean, things have changed so dramatically. I mean, you've got automatic drink machines. You go into the CVS. You have to
check yourself out,
which I don't like. I'd rather... I'm not looking for that.
So the reason I disagree with Salim's answer is not because I wouldn't like to see poor people do better. The reason I disagree is because I don't think the government can wave a magic wand to make happen. The way you make people do better is that we know how you do it. You offer a better education to people, you make neighborhoods safer, and you try your best to encourage stable families where children are born into a family with two parents. And if we can do that, then we can overcome a lot.
William Julius Wilson made it clear that part of the reason why that's not happening is because there's a lack of jobs. Those same areas where you find these fractured families are also areas where there used to be employment for folks who didn't need education.
Charlie, let's look why there's a lack of jobs. It's because of the minimum wage. I mean, basic economics will tell you unemployment is created because of wage laws. I mean, let's think about it. $7.25 an hour is a barrier to entry for entrepreneurs that want to create jobs.
Think about the executive salaries of these folks and compared to the workers.
Instead of throwing rocks at the top of the building, let's fix the elevator.
Enormous.
Opportunity and entrepreneurship is the backbone of this country.
The way we look at this is incredible to me. We don't even think about the fact that these people are not being paid money that allows them
then
to...
Then why did they take the job? Why did they take the job?
1-800-723-8829. We got callers on the line. Again, are you a fast food worker? Let's hear from the front line. 1-800-723-8829. I'm Bruce Dumont. Go ahead. We are back. Let's go to Alan in Park Ridge, Illinois, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. You want to talk about fast food workers. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello, people. I'll be quick here. See, these people, those fast food workers, I guess you would consider them lower class or lower middle class, if at all that. And see, they vote and elect people for representation, people that are going to speak up for them and help them. And they can't put their life's fate into the hands of the corporate of America, that of the Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgans. They have to have a voice in Washington with hopes that their representatives can improve their lifestyle a little bit, maybe speak up for them in a time of need.
Alan, let me ask you a question, because, again, I think I know, what side you are in this debate. And I agree with you that, obviously, every political party believes they have a constituency that they want to speak up for because they, in turn, support that party's positions. But when you go into a fast food restaurant or go into any restaurant or go into a Walmart, do you worry about what that person is being paid? Do you care about what that person is being paid? Or are you, and I assume that you probably make more, or if you're retired, you made more than $7.25 an hour. Do you care about them?
I hate to see anybody taken advantage of just because they're willing to be taken advantage of to some extent.
If someone's singular skill is taking frozen burgers and putting them on a grill and flipping them periodically, does that take great skill?
Now you're being facetious here.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I don't mean to be facetious. I'm just saying
you're being slightly facetious.
Well. All right. Well,
what about the guy that pushes is the that, groom is that in a the 15, GM plant?
Let me ask you. I mean, is that a $15 an hour job?
Whatever the market will bear is running down the field with a football.
It produces a good and service for millions of people.
No, but let's get back to your example, Bruce. So let's say you double the cost of the labor, which means you inherently increase the cost of the product. The same person is still working there. You're not getting a higher level of competency. Mm-hmm. Is the service going to be any better to justify the higher cost of the product and the higher cost of the labor? Or are you going to have the same – you're going to be asking consumers – remember, there's a consumer aspect to this as well. You're going to be asking consumers to pay more for the same quality and the same service.
What will Charles. Happen is corporations won't pay more than, let's say, $15 – could be 17, could be 13, unless that worker is worth more than 13 right. or 15 or $17 to them.
Or the social cost of that worker.
The corporation that's making that decision has to say, if I add this worker at $15, will I do better than if I don't hire her?
Right. Will I
get
more
customers?
If they
can't answer that question yes, then there's a problem because those people become either long-term unemployed or you hire only a small subset of them that are especially talented and efficient, and people who are looking to get the first step on the rung up the ladder can't prove to the next employer that they will show up constantly at 8 a.m. every morning for a whole year and not get fired, which is an important thing.
Right.
Charlie.
So to agree with you, when the minimum wage is increased, you see the least productive and the least experienced workers lose jobs. And who are those people in our society right now? Those are young people, and those are people in more impoverished areas. They don't have
and
the skill set.
And poorly educated.
Right, poorly educated. And that's it's a discrimination when you think about it. If you're going to raise a minimum wage, you're going to discriminate against people who need the jobs the most. Because the good worker, the guy that speaks really well, flips the burgers really quick, understands the system, he'll be fine no matter what the minimum wage is. But if you raise a minimum wage, you're discriminating against all the people that don't have the skill set that would naturally
you're allowing
go
them to live and pay and feed their families. That's what you're doing.
If they
and,
were
and
all to be
employed,
the social,
to keep their
the
jobs.
Social cost
if
of,
they kept their
the
jobs,
social,
they
the social jobs. Cost, the social cost of not employing them or not paying them a minimum wage is increased disparities of wealth in this society, increased fragmentation, increased crime, increased instability in our inner cities, and increased a decrease in profit in places like the Gold Coast where they're afraid of criminal flash mobs appearing out of nowhere. The social cost of being niggardly in the way we treat our lower paid employees is going to cost the society much more than raising the minimum wage.
But the cost of society is also the welfare state having to take over for all.
Exactly. Well,
no,
you call it welfare state. I call it
it's the welfare state will have to support those who can no longer qualify for these jobs because there aren't as many because they've raised the minimum wage. If you go from $7.50 to $15, you're doubling it. So let's say you cut the number of jobs in half to keep your labor costs the same. Mm. Those people who are no longer eligible for the job, not necessarily because of their performance, because the job doesn't exist, somebody else is going to have to support them.
Charlie.
The best social program is a job. I truly believe that. And the people that had the minimum wage, they don't stay there very long. It's a study shown people who have minimum wage jobs, they stay there for about 4 to 6 months.
I mean, look at the unemployment rates in these
absolutely.
In various parts
15%
of
amongst youth. If the youth can't find jobs, why would you want to make it harder for employers to hire them?
Would you make sure that they have jobs? You make
but then if
more
you're raising
jobs
the
available.
Minimum wage, you are making it harder
the
to hire young people.
If the government,
one at a time,
the
Charles,
corporate was taxed adequately, there would be.
We have the highest corporate income tax in the free world.
Oh, if
we
if,
do,
if,
it's a fact.
If
look at Sweden, look if, at Denmark, which if, are much if, more efficient societies. Look at these. I don't know what
Sweden
you guys
has
are talking
moved.
About,
Sweden
really.
Has moved in the other direction. If you look
very slightly,
if you look at government intervention, if extensive government planning intervention, we know better than you, we went to Harvard, could do all of this, then
and you
our
went to Harvard.
I say that, and Yale.
Well, I went to Princeton.
And I do know better, actually. But if those people could actually make all this work by waving their magic wand, then we'd have a healthcare system that looks smooth and running
and
clean.
And a website that would work.
We'd have
postal
a post
service.
Office that wasn't going broke. We'd have public schools, which are a monopoly, and where we've increased fourfold in real terms the spending per child since 1960, and all of that has failed.
We've got to pause. Charles Lipson, thank you very much for being with us in hour number one. You'll be back for hour number two. Salim Mulwakil also being with us around the round table this week. We also have John McGovern and we have Charlie Kirk. They will all be back for the full hour coming up on radio from coast to coast and border to border. If you're watching this program on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight with commentary by Charlie Kirk of Turning Point USA, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, public affairs consultant John McGovern, and progressive commentator Salim Mulwakil. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8029. That's toll free. 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. You can go to the website, beyondthebeltway.com. And again, we're plugging our new Twitter account. If you would like to tweet with me and become one of my followers, you go to @BTB, like Beyond the Beltway, @BTBDumont. @BTBDumont. We began the broadcast with one follower. We've soared to 19 followers. So let's see if we can get to, maybe we can get to 40 followers by the time we go off the air. So,
it's going to be like again, a Jerry Lewis telethon.
It's going to be like a telethon. All right, Tiffany, please.
We got people at the lines now.
People standing by.
We're standing by waiting to take your calls.
Well, my audience may be a little bit older, so maybe they don't, maybe their fingers, it's hard to think. Maybe that's it. Anyway, we have been talking in hour number one. We spent the first portion of our broadcast talking about the life and legacy of Nelson Mandela, and the world will gather on Tuesday. World leaders will be going to South Africa, and again, he will be laid to rest 1 week from today. And one of the other things that I just sort of want to say in sort of observation, I mean, when someone passes away, there is this sense of solemnness and mourning. And one of the things that I find sort of enjoyable is the way in which the South Africans celebrate. They celebrate one's life, and they may be mourning in the heart, but again, it is a spirit of celebration. And I kind of, I've not seen that before, and I kind of, I'm sort of moved by that as a way to celebrate someone's life and not purely...
New Orleans.
Yeah, well, New Orleans, yeah, that's
it's always
right.
A very similar.
It's all, and they, that's right, they go to the, mm-hmm.
The parades.
The band, right to the parades, yeah. Right to the cemeteries. We are also talking about minimum wage jobs in the United States. Many of those who are working for fast food restaurants and other low wage, minimum wage, which is now $7.25. The movement is growing. It has been led by some of the unions. The Service Employees Union has been out there in the forefront. They represent some of those in the fast food business. But they really, they want to organize more. They're making their case that if someone is making $7.25 an hour, there's no way in which they can survive, that those people are barely, that they're below the poverty level. They need food stamps. They may be raising children. And again, one of the things that Charlie said in the first hour was that, you know, I guess a large percentage are young people. There's another report that did came out. This came out from the University of California at Berkeley, which is sort of a, looks at those numbers a little less conservatively than maybe the Heritage Foundation did. But they, according to them, the typical fast food worker is over 20 years old, they are raising a child, and 68% are the primary wage earners in their families. This is according to a University of Illinois and a University of Chicago, or University of California, Berkeley report. You are citing a Heritage report that suggested most of them are young. Just sort of my gut reaction would be it seems like more of them are younger than sort of meet this demographic. But, again, we're having lots of people call in with their thoughts. Let's go to Greg in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening to us on WLS Radio. Wants to talk about working their way up the ladder. Go ahead, Greg. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Salim,
I like it when you're on the show because you present very cogent counter arguments to my points of view and the other gentlemen that are on there tonight. I got a feeling if you're my next door neighbor, we'd be having some great cookouts and some great political discussions. So I always enjoy it when you're on there, and I mean that sincerely.
Thank you.
Even though I disagree with you like 98% of the time.
Okay.
To the point, when I started working in high school back in 1970-71, minimum wage was $1.50 an hour. And I had no intention of staying at $1.50 an hour. So what did I do to make myself more worthy? I busted my rear end, made myself worthy to my employer, and within 6 months I was in management. And from there I grew up into corporate management with another company, getting a very nice living and a very nice salary and enjoying life. And that's how the ladder is supposed to be climbed. A minimum wage job is an entry-level job. It is a job like you start in the corporate mailroom, and you maybe, if you've got the talent and the chutzpah and the proper attitude, you can work your way up to be a vice president, and those kinds of things happen. Case in point, a guy that I went to high school with flipped burgers at McDonald's after school, as many high schoolers would do, and I saw him at my 30th high school reunion back in 2001, and I said, "Hey, Billy, where are you living?" Well, he said, "I'm living in Brunswick, Georgia." I went to high school in Atlanta. If you know anything about Brunswick, Georgia, you've got to have a nice paycheck to live on Brunswick, Georgia. So I said, "Wow, the good for you. What did you do to be able to afford to live down there?" He says, "You remember I worked at McDonald's in high school?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I own 8. That's how you go up the corporate ladder. It is cheaper for an employer to keep a good employee and reward them with good pay if they show the kind of attitude, perseverance, and ability to move up than it is to keep hiring new people. There's a lot of turnover in minimum wage because people will go for a better job if they can get more money and find somebody that will pay them more money for their level of skill. But again, keeping in mind, it is a entry-level job. And a guy who runs a business like that, and keep in mind these franchisees of these restaurants are not corporations in terms of the giant mega McDonald's corporation. It's a guy who spent a bunch of money to buy the franchise fee, trained, put out a lot of money of his own to get the equipment, et cetera, and then has two primary fixed costs,
and you're right,
labor costs and his cost of goods.
And your point about being a first job, in many cases, the person who gets that first job, they basically know nothing about even flipping burgers. Your response... After this gentleman has thrown this huge bouquet, I know you want to rain on his parade a little bit.
No, I certainly understand exactly the argument that the gentleman is making. But, you know, there are different contexts that we find here. You know, there's a context in which there are no jobs out here for people, and they are forced to take these minimum wage jobs as a primary means of sustenance for their families and for themselves. And so you can't expect them to sustain themselves and live in a way that is healthy with that amount of money. And so we have to incorporate other considerations into this equation. We're using primary economic calibrations to determine what the cost of labor is and what the cost of doing business is. But there are other aspects of this that we need to calibrate into.
Charles Lipson.
One of the things that was interesting to me about the Berkeley study, where they're talking about somebody being over 20, being the primary wage earner in their family and having children. I have a lot of nieces and nephews. They're in the process of getting master's degrees or just starting work. Many of them have just gotten married. None of them have children yet. They were putting all of that off until they'd stabilized. We've got a problem here, and it's not a minimum wage problem exclusively. The people are being paid what they're actually worth to those corporations. Why is it that somebody who's 22 years old now has two or three kids and is the primary wage earner? This is a social decay and breakdown that's far larger than just giving them a slightly bigger wage.
Absolutely much larger.
I want to talk more about that. I'm going to give Charlie and John an opportunity to respond as well, but we do have to break. 1-800-723-8029. Again, at BTB Dumont. You want to join the tweet world, the tweet revolution. It's happening here on Beyond the Beltway. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much. We're soaring to 26 followers on Twitter. So let's see if we can get to 50 before we go off the air at BTB Dumont if you want to be a follower of yours truly on Twitter. Charlie, you were going to make a comment. I know, John, you wanted to make a comment, and then we've got lots of callers on the line, and they all want to talk about this issue.
Right.
Go ahead.
So we were talking about minimum wage and how it, you know, creates jobs, but one point I really want to touch on is I talked to Bernie Marcus, who founded Home Depot, and he was an entrepreneur 30, 40 years ago that now is a huge employer. Home Depot employs nearly 300,000 people a year. You know, lots of people get incomes. But he said—
Best top dogs in Chicago.
Right, and he said when he started— his company, it was almost all minimum wage workers. And he said, you know, if the minimum wage went up to $13, $15 an hour, he would not have been able to create today what he was able to create 30, 40 years ago. So I think we need to also incorporate American entrepreneurship. And right now we're seeing lower and lower rates of American entrepreneurship in startups. And think, would these companies be able to start and exist today if we keep on raising the labor costs the way that some people want to do
it? John?
I mean, I think that's an excellent point. And I just would like to make a practical comment about this. And I'd like to go back to the caller from Indianapolis, the point of working your way up through an institution or a corporation. You know, a minimum wage by its very term is a minimum. No one's saying that a company or an employer can't pay more. They're saying that's the floor. You've got to pay at least that.
Well, welfare was introduced as a temporary device.
Well, correct. So, I mean, but the point is that if you excel and do well in your job, in your company, there's room for improvement and there's room for promotion and there's room for greater salary. And if you make that transition so hard or so flat because you've raised the minimum wage so high that it's very hard for people to move up and improve and be rewarded for doing a good job, you stunt a lot of that growth and a lot of the opportunity.
And we've got evidence of that. Where are the jobs growing in this country? They're not growing in California, in Illinois, and in New York. They're growing in Texas and in Arizona and in states that have embraced the kind of philosophy that you're saying. Texas has created something like between 20 and 30% of all the jobs in the country over the last decade. And that's because they make it easy.
Economic freedom.
In Chicago, it's hard.
Chris in Palatine, Illinois on WLS Coast to Coast. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening. You know, this thing about the minimum wage is amazing. First of all, the buying power of the minimum wage is the equivalent of what it was, I think, in 1968 or 69. And, you know, are prices anywhere near what they were in 1968 and 69? The answer to that, of course, is no.
The also, buying power means that you've deflated it for that. What you said made no sense. I'm sorry. What you said was that the buying power.
Everybody talks about the minimum wage being the job killer. Let's look at North Dakota. Right there, they're paying people who work, you know, in gas stations $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year because they can't afford, they can't find anybody to do the jobs, so they have to pay the money to have people work those jobs. I don't see McDonald's going down, closing down in North Dakota. I don't see these small companies closing down. They're paying it because they have to, because they have to do that to generate the to get the employees to do the job.
They're paying that at McDonald's in North Dakota.
It's because they've had an influx of capital because they've struck oil with new fracking techniques.
Right, and that's the fastest growing economy in the country.
Nobody's
going to
work for $7.25 an hour when they can work in an oil field for $100,000 a year.
They need to find the labor to supply the demand, and there's a demand for those types of things in the economy right now. Whereas in Chicago,
right, exactly.
We haven't struck oil. And
guess what? They are filling, they're paying those jobs, those same hamburger, you know, low-skilled hamburger flippers that are being paid $7.25 an hour, you know, in Texas are now making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year, in North Dakota.
Have you ever tried to get a dollar hamburger at O'Hare or Midway?
I don't eat hamburgers, so.
You can't.
As a matter of fact,
why
do
you cannot? Why? Why can't you?
McDonald's
why can't you get a dollar hamburger at O'Hare or Midway? And the answer is because the cost of doing business. But by the time you pay their rent, follow all their rules, donate to Mayor Emanuel, and before that, donate to Richie Daley, because these places aren't just going to go to anybody. We want somebody we know and like, and there's no dollar hamburgers there, and that's exactly the world. Who loses? Well, people who like to buy dollar hamburgers.
But let's get back to the North Dakota example. It's exactly what I was saying. They're not paying the minimum wage because they don't have to.
Right.
And they're looking for labor. And
they can't get anybody. They can't that's get what it for the market clearing
that's
price
what the market is.
The
point turns against him. I mean, his point was that, you know, now McDonald's are making $30,000, $40,000 an hour. If they warrant that, they'll get it. And that's what we're saying. The market will supply the market.
If I'm listening to the show this evening and I'm a minimum wage, I'm heading to North Dakota.
That's
exactly
right. You're getting in a car, you're heading up to Billings.
And that's why
you can't find any place to live. That's one of the problems. Right
now, they're paying so much because housing is so expensive.
They're paying constructors a lot of money as well.
Right, because, I mean, it's the economy that's generating all this activity.
That's right.
North Dakota, here we come. Let's go to Fort Wayne, Indiana.
You just can't drink the water because of the fracking that pollutes it all.
Oh, that's a good idea there, Bruce. That's a great idea there you have there.
Whoa, go ahead at Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Hi. I have a sort of unique perspective on this, and I sort of wanted the panel to comment on two things. This is obviously a very complex issue, mm-hmm. and I served in the military. I got out, and I got a job at a fast food restaurant while I was going to school, expecting it to be just an entry-level job, something to hold me over till I finished college. Well, I finished college in 2011. I still can't find a decent job because everywhere I go, I'm either overqualified or they just have so many experienced candidates that I'm not even looked at, and it feels like we're really headed towards having a lost generation, and it feels like that there's a an education bubble that's sort of looming, and that hadn't been discussed in this discussion on minimum wage, and I sort of wanted to get the panel's take on that.
Excellent point.
Thank you.
Charlie?
To go to the education, there's a lot of points touched on there, but the education bubble is something I'm very passionate about. What we're seeing is a lot of people go into college, and in my opinion, they're studying things that don't necessarily, they're not relevant in the job market. You know, they might go for 4 years for a liberal arts degree and get something in creative writing, and that doesn't necessarily make them very marketable when they go and try and find a job in engineering. And, you know, we're seeing this higher education bubble. There's lots of different reasons coming about. But I think, Charles, you know, obviously you're well-versed in this as well. But I would also argue it's because of a massive infusion of government capital coming into it.
You know, I think the other problem with the education situation is I imagine, you know, so many students are graduating with huge debt.
Yeah.
And that's driving a lot of their employment choices. But I think, you know, this is an example of the current economy, whether you want to call it the Obama economy or the economy that we're living in today, that there just aren't jobs out there. I mean, the idea that we went to that unemployment fell to 8% in the last report, and everyone was supposed to cheer that and say how wonderful it was. I mean, that's just not acceptable. I mean, we're just not doing a good enough job of creating jobs.
As the corporations want to continue to make more money for their shareholders, and as they're keeping wages down for their workers, and cutting, in some cases, cutting the corners, or in the experience that I had with Einstein's the other day, and I had to wait in, and I walked out because the service was bad. At what point is the loss of service? When do they factor that in? I mean, when is fast food going to be fast again? A McDonald's that I go to, if I want something regular, I sometimes wait 5 or 6 minutes for it.
I know
that's
exactly what you mean. Exactly. Well, look at call centers, which went to India for a while.
Right.
Those are now coming back because people were finding that they weren't getting very good service.
Right.
Corporations were getting blowback from it. If McDonald's or Einstein Bagels is going to take 5 or 6 minutes, then the place down the street is going to do it better. Look at what's happened with banks. Remember how banks, it used to be inconvenient. There were a lot of regulations. You had to go during banking hours. Now they're allowed to compete. If you don't like the service your bank is giving you, you just go to a different bank. And if you have to stand in a long line, you'll say, either I'll do it electronically, they'll hire somebody so you can photograph your check, or you'll just pick a different bank. So I like that competition.
Banks are also getting out of the service business. They're charging you a fee if you want to talk to somebody or you want to use the teller. I mean, it's...
And also, James Carville was on one of the shows today. He was on with George Stephanopoulos, and he was basically saying the point is that a recent study came out that said many, not all, many bank tellers are also minimum wage. They're on food stamps. They're barely making it. So they're working in the financial service industry. They are the first line of taking money from people,
mm-hmm.
and they are not being paid well enough by the financial corporation and by those way up the ladder. Yeah,
but I think you said something interesting as the lead into this conversation, this part of the conversation, which was corporations are making more and more money and they're spending less. They're hiring fewer people and they're doing less because they are living in and what they believe is economic uncertainty. They are hoarding cash because they don't know where this economy is going. They don't know what their opportunities are, and they don't know where they're going to be able to invest.
Last week or the week before, I don't recall, but the point is I was making the point about those at the top rung of the ladder who are making very, very good money. I'm talking about people that are making millions of dollars a
CEO
year.
Salaries.
Or tens or $20 million a year.
Right.
How do those people sleep at night, Charlie?
Oh, very well. I mean, they created millions of jobs. I don't mean to be facetious, but
I know they do.
The old job creator argument. No, no.
What? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how someone.
Have you ever gotten a job for $20
million? I was looking at the sleep at night.
There's a movie, Trials of Muhammad Ali, talking about Muhammad Ali when he lost his title. But it was talking about the Louisville group that managed him and how much taxes were at that point, how much he had to pay. And I was thinking about, 90% tax rate and that kind of thing. And that's the price that you pay for capitalism. Capitalism automatically creates these kinds of dislocations, these economic dislocations. If you don't have the kind of economic buffer that this kind of taxation provides, then you have a disintegrating society.
Really quick.
Charlie, we need to be moving more toward Switzerland, which is talking about guaranteed incomes rather than the kind of talk that you guys
people out.
And lots of people that want to respond. We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8020. When we come back, Charlie's got a comment. Everybody's got a comment. And by the way, I can report 33. We're up to 33 followers on Twitter at BTB Dumont. Bruce Dumont back. We have some tweets here. Mike Palenti says, love the show. Look forward to it every Sunday. Welcome to Twitterverse. Leona Coyle writes, just go into the fast food restaurant and you will see they are all very young. My kids did it when they were in high school. A Mr. Blue Style. Props to Salim for using the word niggardly in proper context in a sentence. Besides that, your show is lame. Okay. Well, listen, hey, you take the good with the bad. Again, at BTB Dumont, if you would like to join. And we're up to 30. Let's see, what are we?
So
35. We get to 50. Anyway, around the table, let everybody introduce yourself. Charles Lipson, tell everybody who you are and why you're here.
Charles Lipson, University of Chicago. I teach international politics and other political issues. I also write some books about to help students do better work in college, including a book called Doing Honest Work in College. And I'm here because you invited me.
Oh, that's right. That's why you're here. John, same reason. That's why you're here.
Yes, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm John McGovern. I'm an executive vice president with Resolute Consulting, a national public affairs firm based here in Chicago. I've worked in Republican politics for over 20 years, both campaigns and in Washington, working for the former Speaker of the House, Janice Hastert.
And you're also a Princeton grad.
I am a Princeton grad. No Harvard or Yale, I'm sorry to say. But
Charlie.
I'm Charlie Kirk, 20 years old, founder of Turning Point USA, a national student youth movement dedicated to educating college and high school students about free markets, capitalism, and fiscal responsibility. You can follow me on Twitter at CharlieKirk11. I'll follow back. Visit our website, turningpointusa.net.
Oh, by the way, I can follow people back, too, if I want.
That's right. So you should make that offer.
What happens if I don't want to follow them?
Then you don't have to follow them. You only follow the good ones back, the smart ones.
Well, how do you know? Well, like this guy that says the show is lame, I probably not going to follow him.
You probably
it's good to
you don't have to follow him back.
Constructive criticism.
Of course.
Well, no, but at least he cares enough to follow me.
Of course.
He didn't mention me by name, did he, Bruce?
No, not yet. Well, but they might. Those things may be coming in. But let's let Salim introduce himself, and then we'll get back to calls.
Salim Mawakil. Which I didn't mention before, I've been a columnist for both the Tribune and the Sun-Times. Uh-huh. That's a pretty rare distinction in this city. I have, as I say, been a senior editor of In These Times and been pretty active in the alternative media as well as in the mainstream media.
And also a talk show host for WVON.
Also a talk show host for WVON, and I'm here because you invited me, Bruce.
Kurt Semler is one of our tweet fans. He is now going to move to North Dakota.
Flip burgers.
Yeah, he's flipping on burgers. His way to North Dakota, and he's going to buy a new car when he gets there. Let's go to Mike listening to us in Spokane, Washington on KXLY. Go ahead, Mike. Nice to hear from the great state of Washington, one of my favorite states. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Bruce, and you're welcome anytime again, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to
and
you,
to all
friend.
Your guests. And, you know, prayers for the people in Illinois who suffered the tornadoes as well. And congratulations to Michigan State. I was born in Pontiac, so credits to Ohio, though. But as you know, we have a fragmented society, and corporations like Enron, the executives who took all the profits, the workers lost their pensions, and the unions who demand excessive requests, unemployment at 7%. So business and labor need to get together. They need to meet. Maybe some call it a Marshall Plan domestic. There needs to be discussion. Hunger is not corporate or union.
Salim, you agree with that?
I think I hear what he's saying. It sounds reasonable to me.
Charlie?
I disagree. We need less government. We need more economic freedom. Allow entrepreneurs to invest, lower taxes, lower regulation, and allow free people to make free decisions. That's what's made this country great.
But based on the people that you speak with, and you speak to primarily young people with your organization, Turning Point USA, are they optimistic about the future?
Not at all. And actually, this week has been a very interesting one for me, and I've done a lot of commentating on this issue.
You've been on all the cable shows this week.
So the new Harvard poll shows that 52% of millennials want to recall Obama. So they literally want to recall an Xbox. They want to recall Obama, and they want to get him totally out of office. And, I mean, the way I look at it is never before in modern political history has a generation been so quickly and so negatively affected by their own vote. When you really think about it, it hasn't really happened in 50, 60 years, where a generation such as 18 to 29-year-olds have all of a sudden have to pay for what they thought will be created. They have to pay higher premiums now. They have to pay for the unemployment. And they have to pay for these policies that they thought would happen in this idealistic way under President Obama. And my generation's suffering. And it's really a historic time. And young people are really fed up, and they think that Washington as norm is the enemy.
Charlie, Charles.
Please.
Do you find that attitude in the students that you teach at the University of Chicago?
There's a lot of political discussion, but I haven't heard people turning on President Obama in quite that way. But I will say what's striking to me is seeing a government melt down as rapidly as we've seen over the past 2 months. It's really remarkable. The only time I can recall anything like that was when Watergate really began to unravel Nixon's presidency, and then there was a period when Lyndon Johnson finally was just crushed by the Vietnam War. But a series of voluntary, sort of self-inflicted policies that have failed so dramatically, and it's not just failed in the execution. People are beginning to understand a whole series of costs and consequences that are built into the program, which is essentially a redistributional program as well as a healthcare program. And they are just rejecting it in mass. The fact is, if group plans start to be affected like individual plans have been, if group plans next year, and they should be, is the same impact, if that happens, I heard one person say, they'll be hunting Democrats with hunting dogs.
Salim, I want to get your reaction. Is there... when you were on the show about a year ago, you talked about the disappointment that people had in the president, in the black community.
Sure.
They voted for him, but there was disappointment. Has that changed at all in the last 6 months or 6 weeks when things seem to be really going south rather fast for the president?
Yeah. There's significant disappointment. But there also is a quite a bit of circling the wagons because they see this Republican obstructionism as something uniquely oriented at a black president. It hasn't been this way before. And I think one of the reasons why there's been such a deterioration in feelings about the president is because right after
When the Republicans were, when they shut down the government, there was tremendous disaffection for the Republican Party and the public at large, but in the black community, it was really, really viciously anti-Republican. And then when that fell through, when the Democrats won that, so to speak, and then the healthcare website was such an atrocious failure that simply took the wind out of the sails of many people, and they just lost faith in the government in general. And that's what I think.
John, as someone who spent a lot of time with congressional Republicans working for the former Speaker of the House, are you sort of on the inside, sort of licking your chops and sort of somewhat smugly looking at what the congressional elections might look like because the Republicans may be, because of the problems, the apparent problems of the president, because of the website, because of the backing away from the promise? I mean, on the inside, do you think that it's going to be a good year for Republicans congressionally?
I mean, I think it should be a good year. And frankly, I don't think it's about being smug or being overconfident. It's exactly the opposite. It's realizing the complete failure of this administration and making sure that we work extra hard to make sure we are able to take advantage of our opportunity to try to reverse some of these things.
And that will require a positive agenda. You cannot get by just saying no.
I agree. And I think I want to respond to your point, though, about the idea that this collapse has been so fast and so deep, if you will.
Right.
And I think it's because there was no foundation with this administration. And I think any constituency, whether it's African-American constituency, students, anybody that bought into the rhetoric of this administration is now disappointed because there was nothing to back up.
They only sold the sizzle.
Exactly. And it was all about rhetoric.
But what about the Republican opposition?
What about it?
Does that come into the question at all?
How many Republicans voted for Obamacare?
The Republicans had nothing to do with the failure of Obamacare.
Day, my friend, they decided to oppose every single thing he did. Obamacare skated by because it was so jerry-built, he had to appeal to so many constituencies.
No. Now, Obamacare...
Failure was built into it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
For a public option. He shouldn't have been afraid to push for a public option. Well, that's the problem.
Well, I don't know
it
if
so
he could
have... jerry-built because
he wouldn't have gotten it.
He wouldn't have got a committee.
Not
one Republican voted for Obamacare, and they are responsible for the epic failure of that system and its rollout and its website.
Let's go to Greg listening to us in Schaumburg. He wants to get the discussion back on the fast food. Go ahead. You're on the front burner.
I became one of your tweets tonight, too. Incidentally.
Well, thank you very much. We're up to, let's see, I'll give you the report
Charlie
in a minute.
Kirk, if you're the 20-year-old, you're awesome, but Salim, we're still praying for you.
Thank you, man.
Okay, now, I'm tempted, Salim, to go after your last set of comments, but we won't. Two things. If you do the math, in the early part of my career, I had to work a Wendy's store for 3 days as an account executive for an ad agency, and I have to tell you, it was the hardest job I've ever done in my life. Those people, if they are able to make it out, like the guy in Indianapolis said, up to any kind of period of time, they're good. When you work at Wendy's and you're a sandwich person, do you realize all those ingredients have to go on the bun in a certain order? So you're listening to the speaker, you're doing the sandwiches, if you see drinks have to be done, ice is that, man, and then you've got people screaming at you. It is not easy. So if you make it to that next level, they are going to hang on to you.
All right, thanks for that report from the grill. We appreciate that. By the way, we do have a report from Marie McCary, one of our new tweet followers. She's reporting that it is -6 degrees in North Dakota tonight.
Probably just says to herself.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We've made it to 50 tweets at
followers.
BTB.
Yes.
At least we have 50 callers, right?
Followers.
Well, we have 50 listeners. We know we have 50.
Yes, that's right.
At least
50 people are listening to the show.
Yes. And, that's good. That helps the ego. 50 followers, and someone says, let's see, what else somebody said? They want to know, how do I take Salim seriously?
Oh, wow. why'd you choose that one to read?
That's not a fact. Well, listen, I'm just, you know, they've been following
me. You've got more followers than
they're working on the minimum wage right now. Oh, here it is. I am working at my minimum wage job right now, and I am okay with it.
Why are you listening to the radio?
I work at a gas station as a cashier. Well, it's always good to be the cashier when you're working.
There we go.
I'm no pun intended. I was not casting aspersions on you. I'm not even going to mention your name, Robert. But I won't mention your last name. Let's go to Walt listening to us in Des Plaines, Illinois on WLS, the radio home of Dan Proft. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Well, I've been waiting here. I did go to Twitter and sign up.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I wanted to address some comments from earlier in the show that implied that when you raise the minimum wage, there's going to be an increase in unemployment. It was mentioned quite a few times as though it was just an obvious fact. Mm-hmm. And I'd really like to set the facts straight. I'm looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Since 1950 to this year, there is no case, there's never been a proven case where unemployment went up when the minimum wage increased. Matter of fact, if you look at the graphs, you want to reduce unemployment, raise the minimum wage. The graphs are just about in inverse to each other.
There's been remarkably few good studies of this. Alan Krueger, who is a Princeton economist and very much associated with the Democratic Party, did a study that contravened the conventional wisdom by showing that unemployment didn't go up. He was comparing New Jersey, which did have a higher minimum wage than Pennsylvania. But there's I think most people take it for granted that if you make it more expensive for an employer to hire an employee, you'll get less of it. And there are two effects. One is in the short term, and the other is in the long term. The longer term effect, I think, is greater. If you make it expensive for people to work, what will happen is that automation becomes a more attractive alternative, so that people will be it'll make more sense for you to put in an app so that you can simply program your computer as you walk into McDonald's instead of calling that person who has to take the order while she's taking the money. You can save money by sort of substituting capital for labor. The great story of the last two centuries is the substitution of capital for labor and the substitution of technology for human for low-skilled human labor.
Does anyone know that if you go to one of these stores that it's virtually all self-service? I mean, I went to Home Depot today. Much of Home Depot was self-service today.
Right.
When I go to CVS, a drugstore in the Chicagoland area, the one a block away, there's only about four employees in the store.
Right.
Who always have to come up and help me work the machine, as well as every other customer.
They're going to send you to Einstein's Bagels.
But my point is, am I getting better prices? Is there any bargain that I am getting because they have chosen to spend little or no money on having people wait on me?
Yes, yes. Because you can go to a corner store where you do have a lot of people who will wait on you, and people who want to buy expensive clothing with a lot of hand-holding involved. This suit looks better on you, Mr. Dumont, that sort of thing. Those cost more.
I want to be waited on.
Well, then
and
you
can. I don't mind paying more for that. I hate the idea that you got to, you know, this is 20 years old now. I'd like someone to pump my gas.
There's a law in New Jersey.
Do you know why they disappeared?
Because the oil companies wanted to make more money.
No, they disappeared at a moment, very simple moment. Jimmy Carter set a limit on the top price you could charge for gas. So companies which had incorporated in their previous gas price a lot of service simply eliminated all that service and kept charging the same price because the underlying cost of crude had gone up because of the Saudi oil boycott.
And if I want to go to a gas station like I used to when I wanted to get a lube job and have my tires rotated and all that. Yes. All I can get now is Twinkies and Skittles now.
Mm. And Tic Tacs.
I completely agree with you.
There's one point I want to add, and you say, do we see the savings, as the consumer? Yeah. So there was a study done actually about 5 years ago, and it compared Taco Bell, Baja Fresh, and Chipotle, some three similar Mexican restaurants. And Taco Bell's prices were going up for a while. I don't know if you remember that, but they were going up incrementally by like 30, 40, 50 cents. Then Taco Bell had a huge overhaul at management, and they streamlined a lot of automation. They did a lot of things more centralized, and they put more machines in and different ways of microwaving things, and their prices went down dramatically even when inflation was going up. And we saw a really interesting trend amongst the fast food restaurants that Taco Bell almost single-handedly brought prices down amongst that kind of sphere of industry, especially for quick service, and now because of it, the consumers pay less.
And they're in competition.
Yeah, they're in competition.
And also the profit motive, the profit margins of their stockholders has also increased.
Well, the profit was a good thing because since lower prices, we all pay less.
Charlie Kirk has been with us. He is with Turning Point USA, and his Twitter account is?
At CharlieKirk11 and TurningPointUSA.net.
John McGovern has been with us. He is with Resolute Construction. Not construction.
Consulting.
Consulting. Sorry about that. You build businesses for people.
Yes, we'll construct things.
And also, the ever-popular Charles Lipson has been with us from the University of Chicago, the pride of Marks, Mississippi. And Salim Uwakil, also carrying the progressive banner tonight, talk show host for WBON.
Only lonely banner.
Only. Well, but you had a couple of people that sort of liked what you were saying, and then there was the one guy that did not.
Looted people.
By the way, I want to thank all 52 people who become tweet followers of Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much. It's at BTB Dumont. This program is a Jenny B. production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of the program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.